obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, everybody. My name is Mickey Cook, and I'm an alcoholic. The power, really? Wow. I'm really glad to be here, and I'm glad to be sober. And I want to tell you that it's highly unlikely that somebody that's wired the way I'm even wired today could stay sober for any appreciable amount of time. And I'm already moved. I want to thank the committee for asking me. Shirelli and Sandy have been so kind to me. And I get here and I get this huge basket. The basket in the room is so nice that even the porter, when he brought our bags up, we went like, wow. You know, it's like he's probably seen other baskets. And I went, yeah, man, basket's for me. But I'm glad to be here. When Shirelli called me, I'm guessing 6 months ago, I thanked her, you know, thanks for having me, marked it on the calendar, yeah, I'll be there. And my wife was at work and she came home. And I said, Shirelli called me. She asked me to speak at the powwow. She goes, the powwow? Really? There's a vote of confidence. I said, thanks, honey, you know. And, you know, I come here, and it's just, I hope tonight that I can convey to you and develop some kind of contrast of how highly unlikely it is that I'm standing here tonight. You know, I'm in a room with some people that I really admire. There's chandeliers, for crying out loud. I own this suit, and it's not made out of paper. I came here in my own car, and I paid for my own gas. And I'm not using somebody else's credit card for the room, you know. And my mother was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She sponsored somebody in this room, and I thought about her today. And she would be delighted that I'm standing here tonight, but more importantly, she would be impressed once again by you, because you've done this. You've done this. You said, follow my lead. Walk in my footsteps. Do what I do. You can have what we have. And I came here and I said, no, not for me. You don't know. You don't know me. You know, this can't work for me. And I've done the work as badly as I possibly could. I balk at everything. And the result, it works in spite of me, not because of me. Are there any newcomers in the room tonight? Anybody in here in their first 30 days? Welcome. Welcome. I don't know what your perception of Alcoholics Anonymous is tonight when you're sitting there, but I promise you it's wrong. I thought it was kind of lame when I first got here. My God, my mother was a member. I knew they were going to teach me to knit very soon, and I wasn't into that, you know. I didn't want to be a member of any group that my mother was a member. I don't know why I'm thinking about this. I roller skated to my early meetings, not for health reasons. That was my means of transportation. I roller skated. And I'm not talking blading, is that what it's called? I'm talking eight wheels, four on each foot. I roller skated. And I was thinking about, I was on my way to a meeting one night, roller skating, a late night meeting after I got off of work, and some teenagers drove by in a pickup truck with a fire extinguisher and squirted me. And there could have been 10 kids in that truck, and I'm giving them a litany of what I'm thinking about. Had they come back, they could have given me a squirt with a fire extinguisher and an ass whipping. But they didn't. They didn't come back. I know I'm talking about that, but that's what I'm thinking about. I want to tell you about my day today. I'm a quantity thinker. I'm not a quality thinker. You know, it goes through really, really fast. And I try to snatch ideas and weave some kind of tale for you so I don't get the newcomer completely confused. And some people that have been here for a while get like whiplash. Where was he going with that? Anybody follow that, you know? But tell you how my day started today. I got up at 4:30 this morning because my wife and I had to get on the road early to go down to San Diego to Coronado Island and watch my son-in-law come in on the USS Carl Vinson. And I'm going to tell you, that's an event. That's an event. It's just unbelievable. And he's got a two-year-old and a four-year-old boy that hadn't seen him in 286 days. And I want to tell you, that's a sacrifice. And if there's anybody in here that's active military, retired military, I want to thank you for that. I want to thank you for that. That's something I didn't want to miss. I tell you what, prior to coming here, that's something they would hope I would miss. please don't come down to the dock, you know. Doesn't matter that I was there at 7 o'clock in the morning. I would have already been drunk, you know. But they're happy to have me there. And I can hug another man. I can hug my son-in-law and tell him thank you and tell him I love you. And I do love him. And I didn't have that when I got here. When I got here, I was completely shut down. There was nothing going on. Hate and rage, a little bit of that could get fired up. Other than that, I was just numb. I was completely anesthetized and removed from life. I had nothing going on. And you have stirred that in me. You have stirred that in me by the miracle that is Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not the miracle. Alcoholics Anonymous is the miracle. And I'm supposed to tell you in a general way. Oh, first of all, I don't want to forget this because I got to sleep with her tonight. I'm so thrilled that my wife is here with me this week. And, you know, I really am. She was more nervous about my talk than I was. She said, you know, real encouraging things to me, like, please, honey, don't screw up. You know, she prayed me up before the meeting. We held hands and sat there, and she asked God to remove my ego. And then she repeated herself, please, dear God, remove his ego, you know. I heard her talk at a meeting one time, and before the meeting, they prayed her up, and her sponsor was standing there, and they said, please, God, remove Nancy's ego from her talk. And from the podium, I heard my wife say that when her sponsor said, please, God, remove Nancy's ego from her talk, she said she felt her entire talk get sucked right out of her, you know. So I'm not the only one that's saddled with that, you know, and I hope I can separate that from my talk. My prayer every time when I sit and I bow my head and I ask whoever hangs out the moon for you and I call him God, I beg him to please speak to me and through me. I'll get a little sidetracked here. I want to tell you how my initial beginning relationship with God. I had a lot of trouble with it when I first got here. You talked about God, and I knew it was the beads and the crosses and the incense and the priests. I knew that. So I knew what you were talking about, that. And they told me no. And at about 15 months, one of the guys in a men's group that I went to said, why don't you quit trying to not be Catholic so you can find your own God? He might be Catholic. And he was dead right. But what I heard shortly after that is something that really changed for me, and I'll share it for the sake of the new person, or if you're struggling with that power, trying to find that power. I don't care what you want to call it. But somebody was translating the Lord's Prayer. And the first word is Abba. And please don't correct me, because I've been carrying this for nearly 20 years, and it works for me. The first word is Abba, and it's translated, that's not translated to mean father. It's more accurately translated to mean daddy. You know, and I didn't have a father when I was growing up. He left when I was 4 years old. But I had an image of what a daddy was. A daddy only wanted good things for me. A daddy only wanted me to be happy. And I connected to that, and I said, that's the kind of God I can relate to. And that's what I got. That's what I got. I can't annoy my father. He doesn't get angry with me. He wants nothing but the best for me. And I know that, and I didn't feel like that when I got here. And that's my paid political religious announcement. I'm so sorry. But I'm going to tell you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I can only tell you in a general way what it used to be like, because most of the time I wasn't there. It's hearsay, police reports, angry wives and girlfriends, ex-friends that wouldn't talk to me anymore. Strangers on the street could give me a more accurate assessment of how I lived out there. But I want to tell you, I was a tornado. But I was ready for this long before. I like to try to create some contrast of what it was like in that. I needed a drink. I needed a drink in kindergarten. You know, I did. I wanted to tell Sister Wilhelmina, I'll get straight A's from now on if you can give me a martini. You know. But I'll tell you, I come from a very nice family. My mother was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She died 26 years sober. My oldest sister was a hospital administrator. My next sister down was a nun. Then there was me, and I grew up, I never had any career goals, you know. My mother used to talk to me about my career. She mentioned places like San Quentin, Alcatraz, you know. Then my sister below me was, she worked for seriously, the word's not handicapped anymore, challenged children. I mean, if you teach them to recognize their mother, that's a good semester. And my younger brother was a priest. And that's the environment I was raised. Yeah, I stuck out in a family picture. I want to tell you, you could pick me out, you know. But I always felt different. And my little brother, I had this talk with him years ago. It's so funny that I have an ex-nun and an ex-priest in my family. And if my family wants to talk about something that's bothering them or eating at them or they just don't understand or their relationship with that power. They come to me. And the truth is, they come to you. When my sponsor, when my family asks me something about that power, they're saying, what has AA taught you? I don't take credit for any of this. Anyway, my little brother, well, he went to the same schools, ate the same foods, had the same mother, no father, lived in the same neighborhood, exact same environment. And in all of the classrooms, they had a sign. I went to Catholic school. They had a sign in front of the class above the chalkboard that said, God sees me. And I thought, that ain't good. Oh, he sees me like when? You know, like all the time, you know? And I was just afraid that God was a scorekeeper, and he's somewhere up there behind the pearly gates, and he's got that board, and he's going, that Mickey Cookie did it again. He did it again. I was prone, ready for eternal damnation by the time I was in the fourth grade. And I knew it. The flames of hell were licking my ass in the fourth grade. Literally, that's what they called that. Sorry, I shouldn't say that. Yeah, sorry. Delete that from the tape. I didn't say that. But I was afraid, and my brother, who went to the same schools, he saw that God sees me as protection. He saw that as a loving, caring God, somebody that he could go to when he was troubled or scared. I did not see that. I did not have that relationship. And I was uncomfortable and ill at ease and didn't fit in my own skin. All those different ways I've heard it described, that you've heard it described, I was ready for a drink. And the very first time I ever had anything to drink that I remember, I was dared to chug a pint of sloe gin. It might have been a half pint. I really don't remember. It was more than a 13-year-old boy should chug. And I got really, really drunk. I got blackout drunk. You know, and I think really fast. And I woke up in the morning and I had gone blind. And I'm thinking, oh my God, blind drunk. Oh my God, it's a figure of speech. You really do go blind. Oh my God, alcohol. So I'm not drinking it. Well, what had happened is I had puked in my sleep and the syrup and the sloe gin had stuck my eyes shut, you know. But that is a very, very, very small price to pay. That's nothing. I would pay that price every single day of my life to drink. If that was the only price I was paying, I probably wouldn't be here tonight. But it got much worse. It got much worse in that the prices I paid later weren't the physical drunkenness, wasn't the hangover and the vomiting and this eye stuck shut. It was that pain and humiliation. It was that degradation. It was the four horsemen, pain, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I know them so well. You know, I used to quote from the podium, I used to say all the time that it says, fail to recall with sufficient force. I used to say the pain and suffering of a week or a month ago. And that's a pretty profound statement, but it's not what it says. It took me a long time till I heard it correctly. It says, I fail to recall with sufficient force the pain and humiliation of a week or a month ago. Alcoholism continued. One more pitiful and incomprehensible event after another. And that's just how I drank. You know, if it did something for me, I wasn't afraid of God anymore once I had a drink in me. And I drank with a thirst and an earnest from that day forward. I didn't drink every day. I would have, but I couldn't. But once I could get it every day, I drank every day of my life. Before I got here, I drank almost a quart of whiskey every day for 10 years. Social drinking, you know. I didn't have any luck with alcohol. I'm not one of those people that had a lot of fun, you know. I may have. Like I said, I drink to oblivion. If it was fun, it was just going on around me. I wasn't party to it. You know, you'd have to take a picture and prove it to me. I don't remember fun. I remember going to the Seal Beach on the south side of Seal Beach Pier. I'm about 17 or 18 years old. And somebody left me there with a gallon of Red Mountain at about 9 o'clock in the morning. That's enough, you know. And I don't remember how much I drank, but I remember I passed out, I guess, around 9:30. And I fell asleep like this. I was wearing a fatigue jacket, an army fatigue jacket and jeans, and I woke up, I didn't wake up, about five and a half hours later, some good Samaritan came by and woke me up to roll me over and cook me on the other side. Because I'd been laying there for 5 hours and I was burnt to a crisp on half of my face, you know, the bottoms of my feet and the back of my hands, you know. small price to pay. I'm not drinking because I want to. I'm drinking because I have to. I'm drinking because when I can't drink, when you remove me from alcohol, I get irritable and discontented. You get scary to me. Life is scary to me. I remember being in the 10th grade, and I don't have anything in me. I'm not suited to be out there with them without alcohol or something else, you. I'm just not suited to be out there. But I'm in the 10th grade, and my mother's done with me. She started, you know, finding me in the front lawn and going to Mass on Sunday, kind of kid. I was going to Mass on Sunday with my brother, the nun, the priest, and she comes out of Mass, and her 10-year-old son is handcuffed in the back seat of the squad car. Oh, what a proud day for my mother, you know. That's the kind of stuff I presented to my family. And I got arrested for stealing cigarettes. I didn't even smoke, you know. But I knew I should probably practice my stealing skills because I wasn't much of a worker. Turns out I'm still not, you know. But because of you, I show up. But that's how it was. That's how I treated my family. When I was 17 years old, I decided to join the United States Army. I was going to straighten myself out. I had one more good idea. And I went to my mom and I said, Mom, I'm going to join the Army. She could not get her apron off fast enough. It was time to go. Let's go sign you up. And they, you know, I was in the Army the next morning, I think, you know. I'll cut your hair on the way there. Let's go, you know. And I went in the Army, and I had good intentions. I'm a good starter-overer. I'm a starter-overer, you know. I'll start over, and it'll be different. My friend Larry says, starting over gives a loser hope. Yeah, does for me. But I'm a starter-over. I started over 1,000 times. New job, new house, new apartment, new girlfriend, new wife, new wife, new wife. You know, I'm just a starter-overer, you know. I want to tell you, I've been married, this is my fourth marriage, but I've been married to Nancy for 28 years. I don't take any credit. I give you the credit. And the fact that we've never wanted to get divorced on the same day. You know, right? Some days, you know, I'm going to get the cart before the horse here, and I'm going to get back to being in the Army, but I'm sober since February 25th of 1996. It's not my first sobriety date, but I sure hope it's my last one. I'm 19 years sober, 19 and some change. And when I was 2 years sober after my relapse, she gave me a Valentine's Day card, and it said, "Congratulations, I haven't wanted to slit your throat in your sleep for almost 2 years." You know, right? Well, I don't let the truth get in the way of a good story, Nancy, but I know it was something like that. But it was true. I'm hideous when I drink. It's not pretty. But I'm in the service, and I want to do a good job. I started over, and they gave me a good plan. They had a plan for me, and I'm going to try this. This is going to work good. So I talked to the recruiter, and I'm still pretty smart, and I did well on his test, and I was physically still pretty healthy. And he said, "You're going to be special communications." What he sold me on, he said, 16 weeks from now, you'll be on the beach of Hawaii doing special communications. And I said, where do I sign, you know? And I signed up. So I went through basic training, and I was gung-ho. I really was. I was a sharpshooter, and I won the PT thing, physical training thing, because I was skinny as a rail, about a buck 40. I could run like the wind forever. They love that crap in the Army. But I did really, really well. But when I got out of basic training and I got my orders, it wasn't for special communications. It's for 11B10, and that's ground pound and infantry, Fort Lewis, Washington. And I said, oh, no. No, no. You know, as soon as I got orders to all my buddies were going to Vietnam. At least I didn't go to Canada. But I wasn't going to play that. I was special communications Hawaii soldier. You know, I was not Southeast Asia soldier. That wasn't me. So I didn't tell them, but I quit that day. I quit the Army. You can't quit. If you're young enough to join the service, once you go in, you're in. Even if it's not like your job, you go up to your boss and say, shove it, I'm out of here. The Army don't care. They'll lock you up for that, you know. So they gave me a 30-day leave, and 42 days later, I got arrested, you know. And they took me to Fort MacArthur, which was in San Pedro. I'm from Downey in San Pedro. And the officer the day gave me this lecture. He says, Mr. Private Cook. I was always going to be Private Cook. I was never going to be Sergeant Cook or Colonel Cook or General Cook. It was going to be Private Cook. Anyway, Because at Private Cook, you realize that during a time of war, because it was during the Vietnam crisis, that if you're AWOL for more than 30 days, it's considered a desertion, and that's punishable by death? And I said, no, I didn't know that. I was just, I just stopped to have a drink, you know? I really wasn't deserting the Army. I couldn't tell him that I quit. I didn't tell anybody that I quit. He said, you can't do that. You can't do that. And I said, okay. So I clicked my heels like I was going to Kansas, saluted. And what he did is he gave me a bus voucher. He gave me a bus voucher to go to the Greyhound bus station. He said, I want you to go get on that bus, get to Salinas, and report to Fort Ord on Monday morning and face the music. I was probably going to have a general court-martial. And I said, yes, sir. And I'm walking off that base, and I'm a quantity thinker, not a quality thinker. I come up with an idea, instant plan, you know. I came up with a plan. It was a good plan. I don't think it through. I just think, plan, do it. I said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to the Greyhound bus station. I'm going to cash in this bus voucher. It's Friday afternoon. I'm going to go back home, party with the fellas for a couple of days. I'll leave Sunday afternoon. I'll hitchhike up the coast, and I'll be back in plenty of time. Because in your uniform in 1968, if you hitchhiked up the coast, they'd pick you up and buy you lunch. Well, I forgot about the drinking part, you know, so 42 days later, they found me under the dining room table. My sister dropped a dime on me and called the police on me. She knew I wasn't supposed to be home again. And they took me up there in a squad car all the way up 300 miles with my hands behind my back. I was so sore the next day. When they took the handcuffs off, I couldn't get my hands back in front of me. They were like stuck back there like rigor mortis. But so I went back and they gave me 6 months in the stockade and 2/3 of my pay, and I was an escape risk. No, I'm not an escape risk, you know. I quit, but I'm not escaping. But I was a go-home at next chance risk, you know. I was an escape risk, so they gave me 6 months and took 2/3 of my pay. And I don't know, I did 3 or 4 or 5 months, and it was hideous. I don't do jail well. I'm scared all the time, and I just try to blend in. And I got out, and I went home immediately, you know. And I got arrested immediately. And they took me back, and this time they gave me a year. And they took 2/3 of my pay. And I'm not very good at math, but they took 2/3 of my pay the first time and 2/3 of my pay the second time. I owe them money, right? You know, you ain't making much, now I'm making none. But I had quit, you know. And I want to tell you, I have a son that did 10 years honorably. My daughter was just deployed. I don't know where she's floating out there somewhere off the coast of where the bad news is. You know, we don't know exactly. She'll be gone about 7 months. She's in the Navy. My son-in-law just got back. I was not that kind of soldier, obviously. So if you're planning on going in, that's not good soldiering, folks. That's called AWOL. So they gave me a year, and I'm locked up, and I'm just trying to blend in. And one night, I'm in the stairwell, and the reverberation kind of like a bathroom, and we're singing the old standard, "What's your name?" And I could sing a little bit, and I'm doing all the high notes, and I want to be a musician. So I'm down there with the bros, and we're singing, and it sounds really, really good. Well, I go to sleep that night, and I wake up the next morning, and I'm in the emergency room, and I have a cracked skull and several broken ribs. What had happened is Martin Luther King had been killed that day, and I got caught up in the riot. You know, and I just got beat nearly to death. Now I'm terrified. I can't go back to the stockade because I know they'll finish the job the next time. Now I'm an escape risk. Now I'm a run for my life risk. You know, so they put me in the hospital, and I got a bandage on my head, and my ribs are cracked, and they got me handcuffed to the bed, and they have a guard because I'm a big old scary criminal escape risk, right? You know, I'm really not. I'm just a terrified, without any anesthetic alcoholic. Eventually, they got rid of the guard, took off the handcuffs, and made me what they call a parolee. Don't go anywhere. Yes, sir, I'm not going anywhere. As soon as they got rid of that guard, I started making a plan because I knew I had to get out of here and get out of here fast. So I found this shirt with an alligator on it, like a golf shirt, right? And that was my costume. I'm going to put that on and just walk out to Salinas and disappear and never come back again, change my name or something. I don't know what the plan was. I never come up with a good plan. I'm a quantity thinker, right? Not a quality thinker. I say, get a shirt and escape. Good plan. Let's go. You know. So I start to walk off base, and I got this shirt on, and one of the sergeants from the stockade drives up in his Mustang. I'll never forget it. I don't know how he knew I was not in my right mind. I had this alligator shirt on, and my head is wrapped. I got pajama bottoms, foam rubber slippers, and I'm wearing plastic, you know. It wasn't like an Army fashion statement, you know. So he stopped, and he said, Private Cook, right? Private Cook, always going to be private. Good guess, Sergeant. You know, Private Cook, he said, I thought you were in the hospital. I said, yeah, but I was released. He said, I thought they'd release you to the stockade. And I said, no, they released me. I'm going back to my barracks. He said, that doesn't sound right. Let's go check that out. I said, we don't have to check anything out. So he started to get out of the car. I got to go. I got to run. I got to make a plan. So my plan just said, run, plan, run, do it. So he stepped out of the car, and I slammed his leg in the door and took off running. Like I said, I don't make good plans. I'm a quantity thinker, not a quality thinker. I got a cracked skull, broken ribs. I developed pneumonia while I was in the hospital. So I took off running for about 40 yards, right? Then I collapse on the ground and wait for him to come and administer that ass-whipping that I righteously deserve because I slammed his leg in the door. And they put me back in the stockade, and I got out. It's kind of crazy how I got it. My sister came up to visit me, and I walked into the visiting room and burst into tears, and I'm a mess. I don't have any anesthetic. I can't cope out there. If I leave here tonight, I believe this, I'm heading towards my next drink or my next chance to help somebody, not out of virtue, not because I'm a great guy, because I don't deal with them out there very good. You had to teach me how to act differently. So my sister comes in, she's in her full habit, full nun, you know? And I'm babbling, slobbering, hysterical. You got to get me out of here. I knew they're going to kill me. They're going to kill me. Eileen, they're going to kill me. Sister Eileen, Sister Mary or something. And she went to the company commander, and they found out I had bronchial asthma, and I got out of the service an honorable discharge under medical conditions. What a hoot. In case I ever wanted to run for governor. It would have been a lot easier to give me an honorable discharge under mental conditions. They just had to run the right tests. I would have flunked them all. So I got out of the service, and I got drunk, and I got married, and I got drunk, and I got married, and I got drunk, and I got married. Yeah, a multi-marrier. And, by the way, I didn't do that with the benefit of divorce. You know. Just unnecessary, you know. You just don't tell them.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
You know, I left my first wife in a blackout. I didn't know we were leaving. She was probably pissed off about something, but I was drinking Jim Beam, and I was shot to mark. I was drinking Jim Beam and Downey, and I came to at a bluegrass festival in Tucson, Arizona, you know. So I just moved, you know. I had my guitar and everything I owned in a backpack, you know, and I just moved. I just moved, and I was too ashamed to go back. And then, after a while, the shame got to be so great, I'm not ever going back. I can't go back. So in that night, I'll never forget this. That night, I don't know where I'm going to sleep. All of a sudden, I'm a big fan of bluegrass, you know, because they drink wine at bluegrass festivals, and I'm very friendly if you have a bottle of wine. And that night, I tucked into this doorway behind the where they were going to build the Red Roof Inn. And I'm sitting in there, and I'm drunk, and I got a whisper of a pint of Jim Beam in a bag, and all of a sudden this guy named Jimmy walked in. He startled me. I said, oh my God, what are you doing in my doorway? You know, and Jimmy was the town drunk. I didn't know it at the time, only in hindsight. And Jimmy was he lived on the street. I know what it looked like later. I wore street mud for a long time, but I wasn't at that time. I'd only been on the street a couple of days. He'd been on the street a very long time, and he was drinking wine. And I remember thinking, if I ever get that bad, I'm going to stop drinking. I didn't have a clue. I didn't have a clue that I had a problem with alcohol. So I'm living in Tucson, Arizona, just having fun. I got a job at the International Hotel. I applied for the job as executive chef. Yeah, I was a pretty good cook, but they gave me a job as a dishwasher. And I got to make a plan. I got no place to stay, but I got a job, and we're taking the laundry out that night in these big cloth bags and throwing them in this bin. And I'm a quick thinker, and I thought, I'm not saying this to anybody, but I'm thinking, that's a place to live for me. Those laundry bags are soft. So that's where I slept for a couple of nights. And I'm selling plasma. And I'm walking down the street every, I don't know, every 10 days or so. And they're selling a pint of plasma for $8. And I remember walking down there one day, and I walked by this little cafe. And in the window it said stew or soup. I don't remember. $2.25. Maybe. $1.75. The number doesn't matter. And I thought, you know what? I've been kind of sick, you know. I'm going to go back. I'm going to go sell the plasma, get the $8. And the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to have some of that stew. You know, then I'll feel a little better, and maybe I can make another plan, you know. When I get that $8, I know what I got to do. It ain't going to be stew. I need a drink. So that's how I drank. I drank like that. I drank as much as I could for as long as I could. Just as much as I could for as long as I could. And I came back to Los Angeles sometime in 1980 or 81, and my sister had a big party. It was like the prodigal son had returned, and I remember sitting there that night, and I'm playing the guitar. Like I said, I could sing a little bit and play a little bit. And she's got all her friends there that don't know who I am. I got no reputation with them, so I think I'm a pretty decent guy. And they're drinking, and I don't remember how this thing ended. I remember the next morning I wake up, and I'm laying with my face on some shag carpet, and there's like little traces of vomit in my mouth, you know. And everybody's gone, and I know that I've embarrassed my sister. I don't think she planned for me to pass out on her living room floor. I don't think that was part of the party theme, you know. But that's what happens. That's what happens when I drink. I don't know when it's going to stop. I drink until I can't drink anymore. You remove it from me or me from it. I didn't know that. And I left that morning, and I walked out in the kitchen to get that Camel out of my mouth, and I took a drink of water, and I looked out the window, and my brother-in-law was vacuuming his pool. And he'd done very well. He was a good guy. I'd never met him before. And I looked, and he made a grave mistake that morning. He left his wallet on the counter. And I went in his wallet, and I took $5. I don't remember how much money he had, but that was the first time I stopped, and I went, this ain't right. Something's wrong with the way you're living. And somehow I connected it to booze. So I didn't know what I was going to do. I'd been thrown out by wife number three. I was living in a treehouse. You know, that's fun if you're 10. It's not fun if you're 30, you know. And I got kicked out of that treehouse for trying to burn it down. I didn't mean to. What happened is that night I was drinking Red Mountain. You shouldn't drink Red Mountain wine. If you're going back out there, I don't recommend Red Mountain. They still make that? It was like a nickel for a 55-gallon barrel, you know. But it was really cheap. But I'm drinking Red Mountain with a hook over your shoulder because I'm very cool, and I got long hair, and I'm smoking weed out of a Hagen Haag Feistar's pinch scotch bottle that I made a water pipe out of. Smoking weed. Sorry. I'm smoking weed, and I smoked it every day for 15 years just to make sure it wasn't habit-forming, you know. But I'm just about out. And Scott Redman, bless his soul, used to talk about general anesthetic. The day you count backwards from 100, get to 99, 98, and you're out. And that night I was at about 99.5. I was just about out. I was going for out. I'm going for you ain't there anymore. I'm going for I'm not afraid anymore. I'm going for I can fit in. And when, right when I fit in, I pass out. I didn't know that, right? But that particular night, one of my buddies came to see me, and thank God he did, because I was on fire. And I don't mean I was on fire like listening to Jimi Hendrix, fire. I don't mean I was on fire watching religious television. I was on fire. I had leaned into a candle, and my hair was on fire, and the back of my shirt was on fire. I don't know. I'm at 98.5. I'm almost out. I have enough anesthetic in me that I don't notice this stuff. Shortly after that, I went to my mother's house. My mother joined this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, which I thought was a little premature. All she drank was wine, for crying out loud, Bally High. It turns out, yeah, you get Bally High on that stuff, but that's what she drank. My mother was kind of a crotchety old thing before she got her coffee cup at 3:30. She was a school teacher. I didn't realize, but only in hindsight. She'd have a couple of glasses of wine, and she went from Nurse Crawford, Joan Crawford, to just the sweetest mom in the world. You could hit her for a quarter, and she'd sing with you and play catch with you. But before that, stay out of the living room. It's going to be bad. But I went to Mom's house, and I was wearing a pair of blue Dickie tennis shoes that didn't match. I wasn't wearing socks. I hadn't worn underwear in months, maybe years. I had a T-shirt on inside out because it was filthy. I had another T-shirt in a brown paper bag, and it was too dirty to wear. I thought maybe someday I could wash it at the 7-Eleven or something. And I walked, and I knocked on her door, and I said, Mom, can I come in? And she said, no. I said, Mom, I don't want to drink anymore. She said, come on in. And I laid on her couch, and I stayed on her couch, and I started to go to meetings. And I went to lots and lots of meetings. And I got a sponsor. I got a sponsor just to shut you up. Because it'd say things, Mickey, do you got a sponsor yet? And I'd say, no, I haven't found one yet. You know, I was looking for the guy in the white robe with the stigmata or something. I don't know, but you know. And then say things to me like, kid, if you don't have a sponsor, there's an idiot running your life. And I knew they were talking about me. I was quick, you know. So I got a sponsor just to shut you up, and he started to drag me through the process around here, and I started to feel a little better. And at 5.5 years, I had everything I thought I needed to feel good. I was going to lots of meetings. I was talking a little bit. I'd met my wife. We'd gotten married. We had a brand new baby. I had 2 new cars in the driveway. I'd bought a house in North Downey at this restaurant that I'd worked at 7 times. I didn't mean to work there 7 times, but one day on a Sunday at 1 o'clock, they tell me to go smoke. I came back 2.5 years later, right? But I'd worked there 7 times. But after 5.5 years of working there and going every day, my sponsor said, if they tell you to make blue soup, make blue soup. And I'd go every day, on time, have a good attitude, have a good attitude. So at 5.5 years, I'd gone from fry cook to lead cook to sous chef to chef to executive chef to manager to general manager. Not because I'm a great guy, because you taught me how to go to work. And I can, you know, I'm able to talk to people. I can cook a little bit. So 5.5 years, I didn't quit Alcoholics Anonymous, but it became less important. It became a second priority. And then a third priority, and then a low priority. And I don't see this thing happening. I heard somebody say one time, and it's a great description of what happened to me. I used to go to 10 meetings a week, and then 7 meetings a week, 3 meetings a week, 1 meeting a week, and then a glass of wine with dinner. Right? Well, that's a good description they gave for me, but it wasn't exactly what happened for me. I'm 8.5 years sober. I'm probably going to a meeting every couple of months, if I really need to, you know. And I'm 8.5 years, I'm completely insane. I'm coaching Little League, but I'm going to have to kill one of those kids. I can't go to that PTA one more time. I'm going to choke that lady in the red hat. I swear to God, I'm choking her next time. My wife is too loud. My kids are too loud. Nobody can drive. My job, you can't believe how little they pay me. I'm just out of my mind at 8.5 years. I go to my doctor and I tell him what's going on with my neck and my head, and he prescribed Vicodin for me. Ooh, hum of recognition every time I tell that story, you know. You've met my little friend. And he prescribed 100 Vicodin with 6 refills 7 times in 2.5 years. And I don't share. That's 4,200. I always say that because somebody's always going, 600, 7, 420, 4,200. And I respect the tradition, but I want to tell you how I happened to slip into that Vicodin coma. I got that prescription. I left the doctor's office, and I said, you're not taking those. Heck no. You're a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Mind you, I'm not going to meetings. Just going to meetings does not make you a member, I don't think. Taking the actions that everybody else in this room is taking, a lot of the people in this room are taking, what makes you a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. 8.5 years. So I leave the pharmacy and I said, I'm not going to take these, but I start to think, quantity thinker, right? So I know what I'm going to do. I'll fill it the next day in case there's like an emergency, you know. Like, what if I'm at home and I just know that my head is going to explode? You know, I don't want skull and brains all over the wall in front of my kids. I better have them at the ready. So the second day I filled the prescription. Third day, I'm on my way to work and I'm saying, man, you got 100 Vicodin under the front seat of your car. I take medication today. I don't keep it under the front seat of my car. The only thing you keep under the front seat of your car is your drugs and your gun. Yeah, and I always say gun. I'm not a gun guy, you know. I'm a run guy. I didn't have a gun, but I had my Vicodin were there, and I'm on my way to work, and my head's going really, really fast, and I've lost the battle, but I don't know I've lost the battle. I'm not going to take one. You can't take one. No, you're going to be living on the roof of school. You know, you're going to have to be living in 3. I'm not going to take one. Break one in half. Break one in half. I'm a genius. I'm a genius. What a great plan. So I broke one in half, and then I took 3,999 and a half in short order, and I wet it down immediately. As soon as I started taking the Vicodin, I knew that I wasn't sober anymore, and it doesn't do it for me. All Vicodin does is create a dial tone. I don't want dial tone. I want out. I want you to go away and disappear. I want to not be afraid of you. So I wet it down immediately. I went to my bartender at work. I said, Jimmy, I said, make me a drink. I said, but only make one, because make it really strong, because I'm only going to have one. And I could have passed the lie detector test when I told him that. I was going to have one drink. I didn't have one drink. I drank that drink, and next thing I know, it's 1:45 in the evening, at night, and I'm at the Lion Dior, face down on the bar, and the bartender's going, time to go home, honey. Anybody ever been to the Lion Dior? I think it's still there. It's a real toilet. My kind of bar, yeah. It's the kind of place where, I think about this, they have a dartboard, and the dartboard is almost in mint condition. But the area around it's been peppered. And you know, nobody ever sat in the tables near the dartboard, you know, without a helmet. I swear to God, it was bad. So I was out there for about 2.5 years, and if I could have carried a calendar, I would have been able to give you a more accurate assessment of what happened. But I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous on February 25th, 1996, and I was done. I didn't know what I was going to do. Every morning I had a morning meditation. I sat on the side of the bed and I said, "Is today the day?" Because I'm trying to drink and not drink. And some days I just explode for 3 days. Trying to drink and not drink and doing that marijuana maintenance program. Trying to smoke weed, not smoke weed. I want to tell you, marijuana maintenance is not the cure for alcoholism. If you try that, you're going to eat a lot of Doritos, but you're going to get drunk again. I promise you. So I don't know what I'm going to do. I want to die every single day. I want to eat a gun. I want to die every single day because I can't drink the way I want to drink because I don't want to. Something is stopping me. I have a wife and a family. I know that's important, but I'm losing the battle. I'm ready to get it on. And I went to this lady named Pat Smith, who's gravely sick right now, took me to a meeting. And on the way back, she said, "Mickey, are you going to stay?" And I said, "No, Pat." I said, "Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work for me." And I'm so glad that I know that's not true. And I managed to stay. I got a sponsor. I got a sponsor when I came back this time that I wanted to find the meanest person I knew, right? I wanted somebody tough. I wanted somebody to put their finger in my chest and it wouldn't take my crap because I really didn't think I would stay. I want to get loaded every day for 18 months. So I got a woman sponsor. Oh, you go ahead and laugh. I got Tony LaRue. Anybody know Tony LaRue? Yeah, she'll tell you where the bull runs through the buckwheat, I want to tell you, you know. And I said, "Tony, will you sponsor me?" And she said, "Sure, honey." I remember thinking, wow, I'm pretty charming. She must like me, you know. She said, "Come here." She walked me down to the end of the sidewalk at the YMCA. She put her finger in my chest and she said, "Don't you ever lie to me, you son of a bitch." I went, oh, that's the one I heard about. I didn't realize that "sure, honey" was the last nice thing she was ever going to say to me. You know. That's all fun, and I love that woman very much. But I want to tell you that Tony LaRue died this morning at about 10:30. And I waited till this point in my talk to talk about that, because I knew it was going to choke me up. You know, I owe my very life to her. The fact that she put up with my, that she didn't put up with my shenanigans, that she wouldn't take my crap, that she wouldn't listen to me snivel. You're lucky to not get loaded today. Go to the meeting. And she had me read January 6th in the 24-hour day book. And what that says, it says, my decision not to take a drink today is the only security I'm ever going to have. It's not 100 more meetings or a new wife or a bigger car or more money. If I don't choose to take a drink today, I got a chance. The problem is, left to my own devices and those strange mental blank spots in that failure to recall sufficient force to pain and suffering, pain and humiliation a week and a month ago, I will drink again. I know that. I know that. So I come here and you try to introduce me to that power so I can put something between me and that next drink. Sometimes it's Abba, sometimes it's God, and sometimes it's you. Sometimes it's those dirt bags that I sponsor. You know, who knows what it is, you know? But it works for me. And I went to see her. Thank God I went to see her on Saturday. And when I saw her on Saturday, she was alert and alive. And I thanked her, and I cried when I thanked her. I said, "Tony, I feel like I'm here. I feel like I'm saying goodbye to you." And she said, "You are, honey." And I said, "I can't, from where I sit right now, think that I'm ready to go. Are you ready to go?" And she said, "Do I have a goddamn choice?" That was Tony LaRue. But she says, "I'm ready." And I wasn't okay with that. And I held her hand and I thanked her and I cried. And I said, I thank you so much. I thank you for getting me here. I thank you for getting my feet firmly planted in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I had Tony for about 2.5 years. And I got a sponsor for a little while to kind of drag me through the steps. And then I got my sponsor, Tom B., who's in Palm Springs and not at this meeting. I'm not offended. I'm kidding. I hope something's not wrong, you know. I hope he's not so sick that he can't make it to the golf tournament in the morning. I'm just kidding. What's funny is I've had occasion to call Tom and tell him I'm talking in, I'll give you a good example. I was driving out to Santa Maria about three months ago, and it's beautiful. It's about 10:30 in the morning. I'm outside of Santa Barbara, and the Pacific Ocean's on my left hand side. crystal blue with white fluffy clouds in the sky, and I'm in a nice car full of gas, and I mean, I'm way overpaid on the outside stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsor a bunch of guys, do a lot of the stuff in AA, and my head starts to think, and it thinks fast, and left alone, it doesn't think good. You know, David always talk about reverse pyramid thing. It starts small and just gets bigger, 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 you know. So I start to think, you know, here's another weekend blown for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I got stuff to do. I got to work on my backswing, you know. I got stuff to do. And I start to run with this. So I know I'm not going to win this. I call my sponsor. I said, Tom, everything's going good. You know, I'm going out to talk at Santa Maria, and my head's starting to run off. My head's starting to drill me into the ground. After we talked a while, we're laughing a little bit. He says, yeah, you have a really screwed up head. I agree. He says, but your feet are geniuses. I got smart feet. I just show up sometimes. But I got Tom to be a sponsor. And one of the things he had me do is he had me do an inventory of my mother and my father. When he asked me, he said, Mickey, I think you should inventory your mother and your father. My head said, well, Tom, you know, I'm sober about 8 years, you know, and I sponsor a bunch of men. I've probably heard 50 inventories. I've done 10,000 words of inventory, as a matter of fact. I've bled over on everybody's carpet in town. You know, I've pretty much cleared all that stuff up. So if you have some other idea, I'm willing to do that, you know. But this inventory, that's a bit hasty. What I said was, yes, sir, and proceeded to write an inventory. And I wrote an inventory of my mother. I wrote an inventory to my mother, and after I did the inventory, I realized my part. My mother was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she came to me when she'd been sober many years, and I'm sober at the time. She said, Mickey, I want to make amends to you for physical abuse. I'm so sorry for the things that happened. And she did. It was abuse. It was no getting around it. She was not a trophy mom during that time. And at the end, like a good amends, at the end of the amends, she said, is there anything that I can do to make that better? And being the self-centered, resentment-filled jackass that I was, I said, yeah, Mom. I said, it wasn't the beatings. Those heal. It was things that you said to me that killed me, that tore me up. I wish I hadn't said that. That's not a good answer. That's a self-centered, I still resent my mother answer. A few months later, she comes to me, and I guess she'd worked her way through it. She came to me, and she made a mention. She said, Mickey, I want to apologize for the things that I said to you. For telling you that you're not part of my family. For telling you I wish you were never born. For telling me all you're ever going to be is a bum. I apologize for that. And you would think when she made that amends to me that my relationship with her would heal. Didn't heal. But when Tom had me write that inventory, and I was able to get to a ninth step, find out my part in it, I was able to write down of that stealing $20 off the spoon rest in 1957. That's about $400. For being handcuffed in the back of the church. For disappearing for 6.5 years. For the endless amounts of humiliation and shame I brought to my family. I was able to look at me, my relationship with my mother. And she'd passed, and I went to her gravesite, and I sat and I sobbed. And I said, Mom, I'm so sorry for being that son. I'm so sorry for being that son. And then my relationship with my mother changed. Everything shifted. If you don't ever give me another thing, the whole time I'm sober, you gave me the ability to love my mother. My perception of her changed. She raised 5 kids on state aid. She took one hospital administrator, a nun, a priest, a very educated girl, whatever her job is, sorry, and me. That's not her fault. She did it. She put herself through school so she'd be a teacher. I couldn't see any of that. I wanted to blame her for the way I felt. It's her fault that I feel like that. But I was able to go to make amends, and you gave me my mother. I love that. I love you for that. I thank you for that. And I'll work for you for that. I'll do whatever you say in Alcoholics Anonymous just based on that fact. Had me inventory my father. My father left when I was 4 years old, and I thought, inventory of my father? What am I going to write about inventory of my father? So I wrote about 4 years old. I said, you know, you never taught me how to hunt. You never taught me how to fix a lawnmower, how to be a son, how to play second base. I knew I could have pitched for the Dodgers. Why couldn't you? Oh, is there another team? Anyway. Right, Johnny? I knew that it was his fault that the way I felt. And I had to look at my part. And what I knew is that every time you talked about a father, I'd say, I never had a dad. My dad's an alcoholic. My dad left when I was 4 years old. He'd come up back every now and then and just stir up the family. You had a father like mine. you'd feel like I did too. And I realized what I'd done. I realized my part in how I had shut him out. Towards the end of his life, he came around a little bit. He saw Alcoholics Anonymous and Nancy and I. He came to my wedding. I know how hard it was to come to our wedding because he was so afraid. And he was afraid of what he saw, I'm sure. The glances. He left those kids and he was 4 years old. How can he show up at the wedding? The looks, the scorn. And he's an alcoholic. He was drunk that morning, which was helpful. But I know how courageous it was for him to come to my wedding. And he would come and he even held my daughter, Kelsey, who's 28, you know. I know that for some reason he was coming around. I only know in hindsight because of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I could not let him in because I haven't healed my relationship. But I was able to find out what kind of son I was, how I was never good to him either. And I went to his gravesite and I talked to him and I cried again and I apologized for not being a son, for not trying to reach out to him. My mother died a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My father wasn't quite that lucky. My father drank a quart of black velvet and wrote a note apologizing for being the kind of father that I was, the kind of father that leaves his children, the kind of father that just disappears. That's me. He wrote us a letter apologizing for that, drank a quart of black velvet, wrapped himself in a plastic shower curtain, laid on a linoleum kitchen floor, and blew his brains out. I absolutely get that. He didn't want to inconvenience one more person. He was done. He had a good look at his life, couldn't take it anymore. Couldn't imagine life with or without alcohol. He had to find a way out. I absolutely get that. You wonder why I'm here. You wonder why I'm desperate. That's the kind of thinking I got. I know that left to my own devices, I'll say this real quick. One of the things they do to speakers, and I've got a lot of people in this room talk a lot. I don't know if this is a good idea. They fly you to Arizona, and they put you in a hotel room for about 7 hours by yourself. And then say, okay, come to the podium and be shiny. You know, sorry, it didn't work for me. I'm not good by myself. But I understand that. That's how I live. That's the kind of thinking I have. But I come to you and I don't feel that way. I don't feel that way this morning, you know, or this evening. I don't feel that way about myself. I think some days I'm a pretty good guy. I'm a pretty decent husband. I'm a pretty good brother. I'm a pretty good dad. I'm a great grandpa. Hall of Fame grandpa, you know, papa, you know. But I don't ever want to forget where I got that. I don't want to ever take credit for it. I don't take credit for it. I just do the work because I don't want to have to live like that. I just do the work because I want to be able to stay here. I want to be able to stay here and stand up and represent Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the greatest thing in the world that ever happened to me, bar none. You hear that all the time, but I get chills right now, bar none. Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that ever happened to me. I know that. You are the best thing that ever happened to me by far. Howard P. always earns his talk like this. First of all, thank you for being here. Thank you for having me. Thank you for loving me. Thank you for letting me know I know you're there. Thank you for that. Howard always says, and I say the same thing, if you find a place where you see God pass, mark that spot and visit that window often. For me, it's right here. Thank you very much.
You have enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.